Hi, my name's Noreen Jamil, and this is...
Emily Kate Stevens.
Both of us have been diagnosed with long COVID.
And we've created this podcast dedicated to the condition. Welcome to the Long COVID Sessions. Hi, Noreen. How was your week?
My week was good, surprisingly. I seem to have recovered from whatever issues, gut issues I had for the previous 2 weeks. I was having severe bloating that lasted a week. And obviously that's quite unusual. You know, 1 or 2 days is probably acceptable. But when it lasts more than that, then you should probably have it investigated. And yeah, and when I say bloating, I mean, the skin was stretched tight. It was painful. So I took myself off to the doctor. She gave me stool test, the FIT test, you know, where they check for colon cancer, and a gynae appointment. So I had my gynae appointment and I had my scan, and I'll talk to the gynecologist on Thursday. My FIT test came back negative, which is awesome. But apparently I've got H. pylori again, and I had it treated last year. And the doctor said to me, because I said, listen, I had this last year, how come I've got it again? She said, it's in the water.
That is crazy.
Wow, that's kind of gross.
H. pylori is a bacteria
that
infects the gut specifically. Is that right?
Yeah, it's the thing. It's the bacteria that they've found that causes ulcers and ultimately can cause stomach cancer.
Wow.
Yeah, but I'm feeling so much better. It took 2 weeks, I think, for my body to get over whatever it was. I'm feeling so much better, apart from my insomnia. My sleep has really just gone off the rails.
Yeah, and that's been quite a few weeks, hasn't it?
Last month or so. Yeah, I'm sleeping in bursts. I wake up feeling tired. The tiredness is not kind of PM type. It's more just I didn't get enough sleep.
Right.
Or restful sleep. But apart from that, I'm very well. Getting my walks in. My tongue is feeling fine.
Your tongue? We have spoken about previously. Mm-hmm. You took something to try and help that.
I did. So I've been taking these little lozenges, which are K12 Bliss probiotics. I saw them recommended on Twitter. I did my own research. So I just started taking them and they seem to have helped.
Great. But they didn't help with your stomach.
No, these are specifically for oral health and throat health.
Okay.
So it can help with also like helps people who have bad breath because it reduces the bad bacteria in your mouth.
Wow.
Interesting, right?
Really interesting. I've never heard of, what's it called? What's the word? I've lost all my words recently. I've never heard of repopularizing,
It's amazing what we haven't heard of.
It's amazing what we didn't know we needed until we had long COVID.
You know, I'm still convinced we don't need any of this stuff because otherwise how did we function before we got sick?
Well, I would really love to work that out. And like we're always trying to talk to these people to go further upstream, I also remain convinced that we can just go back and fix something that means that we don't need any of this stuff, because the fact that we need this stuff suggests that our systems are just knocked out of kilter and therefore can't produce the hormones and things that are all out of whack right now.
We'll get there. So how was your week, my love?
My week was also good. I had, as you did, a sick child.
Which I think we should talk about because it's fascinating. They've both got strep.
Yeah, and it seems to be really, really flying around these schools. So many of the kids in the classes are sick with a similar thing, although some of them, the cough seems to be the prevalent symptom. So I wonder if we've got a combination of strep and COVID passing around the schools. But the interesting thing for us is that you and I have not got sick. So it seems to be something that's fairly virulent that's passing around the schools, but you and I have not caught it. I've got congestion in my head that I can't hear through one ear, but I haven't got sick.
Yeah, but for me, it could be that I'm already on antibiotics for
the stomach.
H. pylori. Yeah.
So apart from the sick child and myself, I'm pretty good. I have been very tired and I have not been feeling as energetic as I like to try and be. But I think that is also because I have had a child with me 24 hours a day. So when that happens and I'm not able to get out and walk and things, I feel that that actually reduces my energy. I know that this is something that we are going to discuss in an upcoming episode. We have interviewed Rob Vest about the PEM study, but I think some people really don't do well with exercise, especially certain types of exercise. But for me, I find that my energy levels dip the less I do. Does that make sense?
Yeah, now that we're in this kind of plateau of long COVID.
Always though, always I've been someone who needs to sustain my energy. The more I do, the more I feel like doing.
Yeah, but there was a point where you would do it anyway because you mentally needed to do it, but then would have just days in bed, not able to walk the kids to school, horrible, horrible migraines, never-ending migraines. And you would still need to go and do your yoga and stuff because you mentally needed it.
Yeah.
Despite being so poorly.
Yeah.
Is that fair? That's fair, right?
I have always maintained a certain level because of the psychological impact of me not moving. I just don't deal well with it.
Well, I'm really glad you've had a decent week and I've had a decent week.
It's nice, isn't it? Sometimes we can go, yeah, we feel good. We feel okay.
Yeah.
I've been doing this neuro yoga teacher training. And I had a really fascinating session yesterday, which touched on things that we have discussed with previous guests, talking about, there are loads of words escaping me today, talking about rehabilitation from traumatic brain injury. And this is a specifically neurological based retraining your nervous system to heal from traumatic brain injury. And what was absolutely fascinating in that is that every single one of the symptoms of traumatic brain injury correlates with long COVID symptoms. She also treats people with ME/CFS, fibromyalgia, by essentially working on the nervous system. So that's my plan.
She sounds fascinating. Maybe we should have her on.
Yeah, we could. That is something that you and I have been discussing about having some more guests on from possibly what people would view as a more holistic space.
Yeah.
And trying to bring some of those teachings, a lot of the reading that we've been doing, to look at that for long COVID.
And how's your narcolepsy?
It's actually been better. I'm just so tired. Interestingly, that was another thing that is in line with TBI, is the way that we completely use our energy differently now, and the way that we have a completely different sleep requirement to what we had previously. So I know it doesn't sound healthy, but I was fine on 5-6 hours sleep a night. And I would never, ever have contemplated taking a daytime nap. Now I need to sleep 8 hours a night and I would still need to take a daytime nap. I don't really have enough time in the day for that.
I was just going to say, where do you find the time?
I also notice when I have the periods where I'm not very well, that they do seem to coincide with the periods where I've forgotten to do my mindfulness and my breathing and my yoga nidra. And remember, there was a whole phase where I pretty much survived because I did yoga nidra every day and had that sleep, that nap, that re-energizing time in my day. So I'm building that back in. I'm trying to be more strict about it.
All right.
We both seem to be remarkably upbeat for people with long COVID this week, which is slightly contrary to the guest for this week. We spoke to Benjamin Abramoff, who is an assistant professor of physical medicine and rehabilitation at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. He is part of the study that found depleted serotonin in long COVID patients.
The happy hormone. No wonder we're a miserable bunch, honestly. Another fascinating conversation. And he had more to offer than even the study with his background in physical medicine.
A good holistic look at the patient, I think, because they didn't enter the study specifically looking for that angle. And it sounds like they've got some interesting work coming up and some good directions in which they might be going. You have been working as director of the post-COVID assessment and recovery clinic there for over 3 years, but you're a neurologist. You're also the director of the spinal cord injury program. So can you just explain to us how your experience in that field brought you to be heading up the long COVID service there?
Yeah. So I'm a physiatrist, which is physical medicine and rehabilitation. So the background is that I was all in doing all my kind of academic work in spinal cord injury medicine for people who've had traumatic spinal cord injuries, resulting in things like paraplegia or quadriplegia. But I always had this background interest and secondary interest in critical illness recovery. So in people who had been in the ICU for prolonged periods of time, who had been in sepsis, in the hospital or on a ventilator, and how they recover from those types of illnesses. So when COVID first came around in 2020, we expected this huge influx of patients who had been critically ill and who needed comprehensive care, rehabilitation, help directing and managing their whole continuum of symptoms. But what pretty quickly became apparent was that it went well beyond those who were in the hospital and critically ill, and included patients who might have had more mild initial illnesses, may have been treated at home, but were still having very severe residual symptoms, oftentimes affecting many different organ systems at the same time.
So it's essentially your knowledge of dealing with multi-systemic illnesses. But the relevance of the spinal cord injury in this whole process, we did an interview recently where it was almost compared to traumatic brain injury. What is your opinion of long COVID in terms of its impact on the brain, physically on the brain?
Yeah, so I think first you kind of hit the nail on the head in terms of how is this kind of related to spinal cord injury, and that these are both multi-system illnesses that affect neurologic function, but also things like bowel, bladder. People have rashes, people have cardiac impairment, pulmonary impairment. So similar to spinal cord injury, we have to kind of look at the whole patient. And also another, I think, really powerful similarity is that both fields are focused on, at this time, on function and how do we get people feeling better and more able to do those things that they want to do. And just like for long COVID at this point, there's no cure for it. It's the same that can be said about spinal cord injury medicine and people who have spinal cord injuries. There's no cure that will fix the spinal cord after an injury has been sustained. But there are ways that you can really function and have a very satisfactory and high quality life where your spinal cord injury is not interfering with your day-to-day function, goals, activities. And then to answer your second question regarding neurologic function, I'm not sure I can answer how does long COVID affect the brain, but we know that the symptoms of long COVID are often neurologic. Brain fog, confusion, memory issues, word finding. This is often referred to as brain fog for many of our patients, but also other neurologic functions like numbness and tingling, neuropathic pain, autonomic system impairment. And we have some thoughts from our study about how potential mechanism of this could be happening, but we still are learning about this. We're learning about what changes are happening in the brain. Because while there are some advanced studies that have suggested potential changes, we have seen that cognitive function is clearly diminished for many of our patients with long COVID. But when you look at like typical testing, like MRIs and EMGs, things that are done on a day-to-day basis in the hospital, those types of tests are usually normal.
Before we go on to the study, can you just tell us about your actual clinic, your long COVID clinic? How many people are there? Do you have coming to see you? Is it growing? What are the types of patients? Because we do talk to a lot of people who specialize in long COVID, but not many of them have access to large groups of patients or they're working in research. It's always interesting to see where we are at this present moment in terms of patient cohort.
We've seen about 2,000 patients to date in our long COVID clinic in the whole spectrum. Patients who are mildly ill initially, maybe have one or two residual symptoms that can't exercise like they did before, maybe isolated smell and taste disorders that are bothering them because they can't go out eat at their favorite restaurant anymore, to patients who are really debilitated, even those both who have been critically ill and had acute complications, been on the ventilator, and those who are mildly ill. And the vast majority of the people that we see were more mildly ill and continue to have symptoms. We still see a very steady flow of patients. We probably get somewhere in the range of 10 to 15 new patients a week with ongoing symptoms of long COVID. We're a little bit delayed behind kind of when the waves happen of acute COVID. So we still are seeing many patients from last winter who are having persistent symptoms. We also see patients from early on, 2020 and 2021, who have persistent symptoms and have either gone and seen various providers. One thing that has happened is many of the long COVID clinics have closed. So that may be skewing things in terms of numbers as well. And that as kind of less clinics are in existence, our numbers stay stable because those clinics are closing down. The way we kind of operate, we do a very comprehensive evaluation. We do certain standardized screening questionnaires. And then based on the patient's presentation, we'll either recommend additional diagnostics. Long COVID is a diagnosis of exclusion, so making sure there's nothing that's directly treatable that may be causing their symptoms. Or if we don't think any diagnostics are needed, or in addition, we'll recommend different treatments as well as referrals if necessary within our system to people who have some expertise in managing long COVID patients.
And what makes up your MDT there? What specialties do you provide feed into the long COVID patient?
Everybody who's seen in our clinic are seen first by a physical medicine and rehabilitation provider, a physiatrist. And then we've developed a larger team over time through various specialties, including pulmonology, cardiology. We have some great therapists who know how to manage and do physical therapy and speech language pathology, which is for cognitive function for our patients. We have neuropsychologists that we work with. And so it's a big team, but we really base the kind of second steps or the referrals based on what the patient needs. So it's not like everybody is seeing all those different providers. And unfortunately, we're not a one-stop shop as much as I'd love to be. We're kind of what I describe as a hub and spoke model. So they come to us and then we can direct them to resources. And oftentimes our patients come from all over the state and even sometimes outside the local region. And so we can try to establish them with people close to home too, when necessary. So it's not that everybody is following up with a pulmonologist at Penn. And then oftentimes these patients have seen a lot of providers before. So it's a matter of kind of collaborating with those outside providers and giving our input so they know what our thoughts are, and what is consistent with long COVID. Sometimes things are not consistent with long COVID and they deserve additional workup too.
Have you seen people actually recovering to the point that you would call it recovery with the symptomatic relief that you have given?
So the way I anecdotally tell this, and there's been some studies that are suggestive of similar patterns, I'd say somewhere in like the 5%, maybe 10% range have recalcitrant symptoms that do not get any better. No matter what we do, they feel really terrible and they don't really make much progress in my experience. And then we have like 5 or 10%, maybe even a little bit more, who do get better. And these are usually people we see earlier on after their infection, within the first 6 months. Oftentimes they have more isolated symptoms like pain or GI symptoms. And some of those patients get 100% back to their previous baseline. And we have certainly seen that. And then the vast majority of patients in our experience, I would say, get better. A lot of them get a lot better. And so they say, hey, I'm able to get back to activities. I'm back at work. I'm doing a lot of things I like to do, but I'm not necessarily who I was before COVID. I think that's the majority of patients. So that degree of recovery is quite broad, from kind of mild recovery to pretty significant recovery, but they're not necessarily who they were before they had COVID.
Yeah, or 100%. That's sort of what Noreen and I say a lot. We still have crashes. We still have times where we really do not feel well. But from where we were 3 years ago, there is considerable progress. So shall we dig into the study?
Yeah, I'll give a little bit different context of where the study came from. One of the fortunate things here at our institution is that we have a lot of really excellent basic scientists who really have their finger on the pulse of what some of the needs are in terms of doing studies and looking deeply into their applying their research to new diseases, new syndromes. And so really from the beginning of Open Air Clinic, we had in the back of our minds, hey, how do we get these patients hooked up with basic science researchers? And I'm primarily a clinician, but there's really excellent PhD level scientists here who are interested in long COVID. And so every patient from almost day one who came through the door, we asked, do you want to be contacted by researchers? And are you open to participating in studies?
And did you find that most were interested?
Vast, vast majority were interested in being part of research studies. I could look at the number, but probably greater than 95%, because they're suffering and they want answers. They want to know what's wrong with them. And obviously, they hope that they get into a study with a new treatment that benefits them directly. And so from the beginning, our group and actually three different basic science labs here at Penn collaborated to collect blood samples and some phenotypic data on these patients in addition to what we collect in clinic, and really take a deep dive into what is different about these patients, what is different about them compared to those who recover from long COVID.
And in terms of those different labs, you're talking about microbiology. What other specialties have you brought in to do that kind of testing?
It's really Dr. Cherry, Dr. Chess, and Dr. Levy, who are our main collaborators on the project. Dr. Chess and Dr. Levy are both experts in like metabolomics and kind of how your body, your brain-gut connection and things along those lines.
So was it something that was picked up from some of this blood work that was taken initially, or were you actually looking for this drop in serotonin?
They started essentially by taking a really broad perspective and saying, hey, what metabolites are different in long COVID versus those who had recovered? And doing that in a more unbiased approach, they found that the strongest signal was coming from serotonin. And so peripheral serotonin levels were very similar between those who are acutely affected with COVID and those who had long COVID, and very different and much lower than those who had recovered from COVID and did not have persistent symptoms.
Okay, so can you explain what you perceived to be that pathway that leads to the serotonin depletion in the long COVID patients, please?
Through these very elegant studies that my co-collaborators performed, they discovered that there's likely three distinct mechanisms that are all playing a role in the decrease in serotonin. One is decreased tryptophan absorption from the GI tract. The second is platelet issues, so thrombocytopenia, possibly hyperactivation of platelets. And then the third being increased turnover through MAO, which is the main enzyme that degrades serotonin. And we think this is all likely driven by interferon, which is a pro-inflammatory cytokine, interferon 1, type 1 interferons. And then my suspicion, at least, and what some of our data hints at, but we're not able to say this definitively yet, is that possibly due to a persistent viral reservoir, persistent viral RNA, which is thought to be higher in our patients that have persistent symptoms, long COVID, compared to those recovered controls. So the overall pathway here that we envision is that the persistent viral reservoir is potentially leading to increased inflammatory response, increase in type 1 interferons, which is leading to then the peripheral serotonin depletion, which is a separate reservoir, separate store of serotonin compared to the brain in the CNS, because serotonin does not cross the blood-brain barrier. So that's the mechanism that we're seeing, particularly in mouse models. So the question is still, you know, does this directly translate from mice to humans? But it also suggests this was not only seen with COVID in the mouse model, but other viral infections. So this may explain other chronic fatigue illnesses. And there's other conditions that have shown increase in type 1 interferons and pro-inflammatory cytokines, and that decrease in serotonin may be contributed to things like fatigue and cognitive impairment in those populations. We know, and we've seen in other studies, evidence of viral reservoirs. We've seen in other studies evidence of increase in interferons in long COVID patients. And we've seen evidence of thrombocytopenia and platelet changes in those with long COVID. So putting those all together, this can help fit some of those pieces together that seem separate into one pathway, if that makes sense.
Can I just clarify the cohort that you've used for this? I believe it says in the paper that it is a subset of patients. Can you just clarify how that subset was selected? Because I believe that you've also used data collected from the LINC study from the team at UCSF, who we are big fans of. We've spoken to them. But how did you select which data you were going to bring into this?
So these were actually just essentially the first 60 long COVID patients that had come out of our clinic with the diagnosis of long COVID who were interested and contacted and came in for their blood draws.
Okay, so it wasn't specific symptoms or only if you have a viral reservoir confirmed or anything like that. It was more random than that.
Correct. And we actually looked at, we took our whole clinic population and we did some cluster analysis to kind of try to cluster these patients and were neurocognitive symptoms or cardiac symptoms or GI symptoms. And these patients came from kind of all the different clusters. And this effect of decreased serotonin was seen across the board. And as you mentioned, this decrease in serotonin was seen in other clinical populations, like the UCSF population and a study that came out of Ireland too. So those blood samples of patients with long COVID also demonstrated this phenomenon of the decreased peripheral serotonin levels.
And how would you describe the level of decrease? Was it significant or is it 10%? Or how would you describe it in terms of...
Yeah, it was pretty dramatic.
Right.
I don't know if I can really describe it as like a percentage, but it was definitely a very significant finding.
And was the decrease relative to the symptomatology, as in those people with more severe symptoms, did they have more of a depletion?
Yes. Particularly, I believe in that UCSF study, when looking at that population, the more symptoms they had, the lower the serotonin levels.
I was just interested in the tryptophan theory, because obviously tryptophan you can buy over the counter. So before we all rush out and buy some.
Yeah.
It's not the tryptophan is not there. It's not being absorbed by the body properly. Is that correct? Is that what you call malabsorption?
Yeah. So we think it's due to the absorption of tryptophan from the diet for different reasons, which I won't go into. But we don't know yet. If we know in the mouse model, we could, by giving tryptophan and 5-HTP, we could increase those levels. But whether that can be done and it's analogous in the human and humans, we don't know. So I think that's a big takeaway from this whole study, is that just because something has been shown in mouse models doesn't mean we're ready yet to declare it as proof for humans. But that being said, you know, these are then things that we need to target and think about and do studies on in humans, whether that's ideally randomized controlled trials or retrospective cohort trials, to really understand what is causing these symptoms. And I think that's in a lot of ways the next step here, is how do we translate this into things that can be useful for everybody out there who's really suffering with long COVID.
And is that something that you have the capacity for, obviously, given the correct funding and all of the rigmarole that you have to go to? Is that something that you actually have the infrastructure to try and implement if someone were to say, okay, do a clinical trial into 5-HCP for treating long COVID patients?
Yeah, and that's kind of the stage we're at now, is looking at how do we make something like that happen and what's the lowest hanging fruit where we can get answers to patients the fastest. Because research can be very slow, but patients have been waiting many years for good, high quality studies. And the worst thing you can do is do this incorrectly and then either cause patients to go down the wrong path or decrease funding for these types of studies moving forward. The other thing I would add is one thing that I think is really critical, not just in our research, but research in this field overall, is that the symptoms are so heterogeneous, and we wonder how heterogeneous are the pathophysiologic mechanisms. And so we need to have some biomarkers, in my opinion, that we're looking at as we're doing these studies. We need to look at things like viral reservoir. We need to look at things like serotonin levels, cortisol levels, some of the immune signatures of people with long COVID, to see how do we cluster these patients on a serologic level by looking at their blood, but also what, when we do have treatments and the treatments are successful, does that correlate with any of these physiologic biomarkers?
Yeah, because you need to be able to measure it, essentially. You can't just put these trials through on, well, we're doing it at the moment. It's how do you feel? That is pretty much our marker at the moment, isn't it? How do patients feel?
Right.
But you need some kind of measurement.
Yeah, and it's possible that not everybody has the exact same mechanism. And by clustering and by clumping everybody together, we need to be a little bit more precise, I think, in my opinion. So it's not everybody gets the same treatments for something that looks similar on the surface.
Okay. Just one more note on tryptophan. Tryptophan, or the absorption of tryptophan, is also responsible for niacin and melatonin, I have read. I don't know if it also applies to cortisol, but those are two things that people have been taking orally to help alleviate symptoms of long COVID. Does that actually make sense to you?
So it's not something that we looked at directly in this study, but I think those are the types of questions that I think are very important to continue to look at, because you're right. Tryptophan is a precursor for other, let's say, substances within the body, and we need to be looking at those as well. And those are the types of things we should be directly measuring and evaluating in our long COVID patients.
Well, that draws me back again to the malabsorption. Do we have a theory or working theory of why the body's not able to absorb tryptophan in this case? So there are numerous diseases that do cause malabsorption, the diabetes, Whipple disease, celiac, etc. But I'm just wondering what the working theory is for long COVID, although we do know long COVID is present in the gut.
Yeah, we think it's driven by type 1 interferons and the kind of the inflammatory response, but you'd probably have to talk to the basic scientist a little bit more than me in terms of exactly how that mechanism works. We do have a theory that's in the paper. I just can't speak to it directly, to be honest with you.
No, that's totally fine. We're just trying to make this as digestible for our audience as possible.
Can you explain, though, the impact that that depleted serotonin has on the vagus nerve and how it therefore creates this quite broad-ranging symptomatology?
Yeah, so serotonin is the most prevalent neurotransmitter outside the brain, and it's involved actually in a lot of biophysical mechanisms within the body. Our team noted that serotonin has a major impact on vagal nerve processing, and the vagus nerve is the major sensory nerve through the body, and it picks up how you feel, your autonomic symptoms, your visceral organs, how they feel often gets transmitted through that vagus nerve. But we also know that changes in vagal nerve signaling also affects the hippocampus and kind of your memory, thinking, processing. And that's part of some of the theories, if you've heard of like the gut-brain connection through the vagal nerve. And so even though it's not affected, you know, the serotonin levels aren't directly changed necessarily in the brain, through the vagus nerve and changes in vagal nerve signaling, that can have profound effects on the hippocampus and how you store information and memory and processes like that.
Okay. And you have spoken, the study mentions that one way to address the depleted serotonin and therefore possibly alleviate some symptoms is to use SSRIs. Could you explain approximately how they work, but also tell me, is that another symptom treatment rather than addressing the root cause?
Yeah, so we're hopeful that by increasing serotonin levels, some of the symptoms of long COVID can be mitigated or alleviated. Obviously, there's been many patients with long COVID who have been started on SSRIs for a number of reasons and don't immediately get 100% better. But could this be part of a treatment cocktail, let's say, with some oral tryptophan or 5-HTP supplementation, help to build those levels and so that the patients feel better? So SSRIs are selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. So they increase the levels of serotonin because they're in the blood. And so we're optimistic that treatments like these, like SSRIs, may be helpful for long COVID. And there's actually been one study that's a preprint that has shown some benefit. It's not a randomized controlled trial, but a retrospective trial that patients have had improvement with SSRIs. Now, there's also not an elephant in the room necessarily, but patients who have persisting illness for months and months and months, and they don't feel good and they can't do their activities, can also develop anxiety and depression. And so it's possible that SSRIs may just be impacting those symptoms. And I think this is where we have to really be careful in our clinical trial design to be asking which symptoms are getting better and trying to get at these questions very directly, because we want to know what we're treating. And are we treating the symptoms or are we treating that root cause?
I wonder if there's a study being done on people with depression, because SSRIs are used to treat people with depression, if they ever ended up with long COVID.
Certainly there have been people with depression who have ended up with long COVID who have been on SSRIs before getting sick with COVID. And depression and cognitive dysfunction in individuals with long COVID has also been found to be very correlated. So could this all be through serotonin mechanisms? You know, I sometimes describe it as when I talk about depression in general following long COVID, it could be because of your persistent symptoms, but there may be direct reasons from the disease that are changing your neurochemistry that could be leading to anxiety and depression too.
That's what I always say, isn't it, Noreen? I've never had a history of anxiety or depression previously, but I'm a believer in this sort of theory of the inflamed brain. So your body is inflamed and your mind gets inflamed, and it causes this almost confusion or this brain changes that you don't have, or I didn't have prior.
Right. And patients are so understandably concerned that when we talk about this issue, that because often that's because they've heard it from other providers, you're depressed and that's why you feel terrible, or, you know, you just need to get out more. That type of thing is really can be counterproductive, and I don't think is in line with our understanding of the condition.
It's refreshing to hear. Refreshing to hear from a healthcare provider.
So when it comes to the interferons, so I'm always trying to take a step back when I look at the disease process. So we have depleted serotonin, which is a given with all the blood work that's been researched. We're looking at either malabsorption caused by interferons being inflamed. What's inflaming the interferons?
Yeah, so I think what's causing the inflammatory response in the body, my suspicion, I'll just say personally what my bias is or what my personal belief is.
Please.
Is that it's due to some sort of viral reservoir. We know in lots of different viral infections, the virus sticks around, whether that's EBV, CMV, chickenpox, which becomes shingles later on in life. These viruses may be harbored somewhere in your immune system. And particularly that could be in your GI tract in long COVID. And we've seen viral RNA of COVID spread throughout the body, beyond the lungs, beyond the upper airway. And that doesn't mean it's a reproducing virus or a virus that could be spread or anything like that. But I suspect, my personal suspicion is that the virus is hanging around, and that's leading to persistent inflammation.
So do we, along with your happy cocktail that you created with your SSRIs and 5-HCP, do we need to be taking antivirals, or do we need to address that viral reservoir further upstream? Going back with Noreen, do we need to address that before the SSRIs are really going to have an impact?
So just to be clear, I'm not recommending any type of cocktail at this point. It's more of a theory or something that, you know, could be looked at experimentally through trials down the road. I don't want to be suggesting that now. But and then to answer your second question. So the reason why we're not necessarily asking that question directly as our kind of next steps is that there's already clinical studies looking at that question through looking at Paxlovid. Some of the biggest clinical trials out there are addressing that question. I think that that's in some ways already being covered by the Paxlovid studies. But I think that's a key part of the equation here.
You're staying in your lane, your pathway. And I think it's quite nice. Noreen and I found it quite interesting, the amount of collaboration that has gone on with this condition. Obviously, we don't want to have the condition and we don't want anyone to have to suffer with it. But it has been quite remarkable the way that the scientists and doctors have come together to collaborate and bring their various angles together to try and create an overall treatment.
Yeah, I've been really impressed with that. One thing that I'm involved in, I'll just give a little shout out. Early on in the pandemic, we started through my medical society, the American Academy of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation, a long COVID collaborative of different long COVID clinics in the country. And we've had over 40 clinics now who have joined the collaborative. And we meet monthly, now more kind of every other month. And we discuss issues, we discuss clinical questions, latest research. Sometimes we have presenters on. We came up with very early on the pandemic some clinical guidance statements on the most common conditions, so dysautonomia, fatigue, cardiovascular symptoms, pulmonary symptoms. And that was really coming from different clinicians at very, you can almost say, rival institutions coming together to try to tackle this problem. That also happened on the basic science side too, and having scientists give their samples or run assays across institutions has been really impressive. And I haven't had any experiences of somebody I felt was trying to scoop one another or take anyone's credit. You know, everything's been super collaborative in this space. And for many patients out there who've had chronic fatigue syndrome and post-viral syndromes before long COVID, it's been very refreshing because they didn't have this level of attention on their condition and potentially looking for treatments. And the one thing I'll go back and say, at least here in the United States, the clinical recognition of post-viral syndromes and long COVID particularly has gone up considerably. And I think it's helped patients. And so patients, they may not have answers, let's say, from their primary care physician or their pulmonologist that they wouldn't seen, but they're not being told you don't have anything or it's all in your head nearly as much as when we first started this clinic. Or that was, yeah, I'd hear that with most patients, that they were being dismissed or they were told you don't really have anything. And I think it's important to take patients by their word, take them seriously when they're having these types of issues.
It's encouraging to hear that, actually, because we still hear a lot of patients that we know say that they were dismissed, and both Emily and I along the way have been dismissed. But I agree with you, there's definitely a shift. The amount of doctors looking at these diseases is not just long COVID, but ME/CFS and Lyme and all these other things that are post-viral diseases.
Yeah, and hopefully that gives us some headway into all of those things, but also all of the things that we've been looking at in terms of autoimmunity. There's a huge amount of knowledge that is being pooled. I mean, I sometimes think the field of journalism could do with a little more of this kind of collaboration.
I agree that some of the insights that we get from long COVID are going to spread beyond long COVID directly. I think some of the ways we look at the immune system and some of these metabolomic questions may spread beyond this specific illness.
Do you have a next project that's a spin-off from this paper?
We do have things in mind. I don't know if we're ready to publicize them yet. And we're having ongoing meetings pretty much every week kind of discussing that question.
Oh, go on. Give us a hint.
No, I think we have to think about clinical trials and treatments, but what's, you know, also what's feasible. And it's going to work. Let me go back to kind of something you said before. It's going to work much better if we do this between institutions and we're looking at it from all angles. So we're actively talking to people that I'm sure you've talked to from other institutions to try to find a way that we can work together on this.
Noreen and I, every week, we find it remarkable the size of the brains and the amount of want amongst the scientists and clinicians to actually move forward with this. It's really remarkable. So thank you.
Thanks for having me. I think the people who are doing this are very dedicated. And, you know, I just always concerned that as people have moved on from the pandemic, long COVID gets forgotten about as well. And I think there's a lot of people out there who are still suffering and we can't turn back or move on at this point.
Also, the pandemic isn't over.
No, it's not.
People are still getting COVID, so there will still be patients, new patients, that will unfortunately will be coming to you. Just statistically, that's a fact.
Yeah, and however loud we bang that drum, or all of the long COVID patients try to bang that drum, it still doesn't get heard, does it? Amongst the medical profession, perhaps, but not by the general public.
Yeah, I agree.
He also worked with people with spinal injury and that rehabilitation. So it's, again, coming at it from that angle.
There are quite broad themes that we find, right? People who look at the brain injury, the spine, and they fit into one group. And then they've got the immunologists, and then we've got the endocrinologists, who all have their own theories, which is fascinating. And they all seem to fit every time we talk to someone.
Except for it keeps coming back all of these times to a viral reservoir. So here they found serotonin depletion, but his theory, as he explained, is viral reservoir.
Yeah.
So it makes me think that for all the symptomatic treatment that all of these people talk about, perhaps there's nothing that we can do to alleviate or to stop us from having long COVID until we've addressed that. We've got to get to that root, or everything else is band-aid medicine.
Yeah, but sometimes also the band-aids can help because it lets your body
heal. Yeah.
So we do need to get that island going where we can just go and rest.
Yeah. Long COVID island. I want to call it long COVID love island, but you don't like the love element of it.
No. I don't like people very much.
Look, this whole episode was about the happy hormone. I'm absolutely convinced that the more, you know, I'm not suggesting that we actually have some kind of love island situation. I don't think that sounds like it would be very positive at all. But all of the impacts of positive human contact, because I think there are people who have been left incredibly lonely by this illness. Human contact, loving each other, positivity. I know it all can seem a bit toxic and quite woo-woo, but I think there are health benefits to that in your life. Firmly believe it.
Absolutely. I used to manage sometimes my high blood pressure by getting my youngest child to come and give me a hug.
Yeah.
5 minutes of being around him, hugging, my blood pressure would come right down, or my palpitations would decrease significantly.
That is amazing. So what about Hug Island? Should we have Hug Island?
We could have Hug Island. As long as there's sunshine.
As long as there's sunshine, and if we'd be all pre-tested so that we're not bringing COVID in,
yeah,
we're all allowed to hug. That's better than a happy cocktail. Join us next week as we hear others' experiences of long COVID. Share your stories and questions at tlcsessions.net. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram for the latest updates. And if you found this interesting, please do subscribe.